Counsel, good morning. This is the case of In Re Interest of Victor L. You may be seated at counsel table. And as you can see, six members of the court are here in the courtroom. Justice Miller Lerman is participating by WebEx.
Good morning, Justice Miller Lerman.
And she can hear and see you, and normally you can hear and see her. Justice Miller Lerman, you want to test your sound one more time?
Sure. Justice Miller Lerman here, appearing by WebEx.
Very good. Everything seems to be working. Counsel,
thank you.
When you are not presenting, we would appreciate it if you keep your masks on when you are presenting. Please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Do either of you have any questions before we begin? Thank you very much. Ms. Killian, you may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Natalie Killian, and I'm a Deputy Douglas County Attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska, the appellant in this matter. At this time, I'd like to reserve 90 seconds for rebuttal. Today, the state is asking that this court reverse the dismissal of the juvenile court's dismissal of the status petition against the minor child in interest for several reasons. First, the state would contend that competency is not required in order to adjudicate a minor child for a status offense. And two, if this court is inclined to find that competence is something that is required to adjudicate a status offender, then the state would ask that this court still reverse and remand the lower court's decision to dismiss the status petition in this case, because no attempts at restoration of competence were made, and no legal findings of the inability or ability to be restored to competence were made pursuant to 29-1823.
Has the juvenile code adopted that provision in the criminal code with respect to the competency procedure?
It has not, Your Honor.
Is that significant?
Your Honor, I believe it is significant that the juvenile code itself is silent as to how to restore or assess competence for a minor child, and what to do if presented with an incompetent child. There's an irony there in that the adult criminal code provides a clearer pathway, a decision tree, as identified by State v. Jones, a decision tree for how to assess competence and then restore a person to competence, either through civil commitment or through some kind of commitment to a treatment facility. It's ironic that the juvenile code, which is rehabilitative in nature, does not outline that same procedure. The state
would
ask—
Could that be because they wouldn't leave a wider range of options available in juvenile court?
I think that at least, I don't want to argue. I think that there is an important distinction to be made that the adult criminal code provides a clearer framework for how to assess competence and then later restore competence. I think in this instance, at the very least, there needs to be a finding that the child is unable to be restored to competence within the foreseeable amount of time. How the juvenile court could get around that or get to that point, maybe is something that could be considered. The state's brief, the state argued that the appointment of a guardian ad litem could possibly serve a twofold approach for competence of a minor child, in that the appointment of a guardian ad litem could, one, safeguard the interests of a child who's found to be incompetent. But the appointment of a guardian ad litem could also be a method for the restoration of competence. This is a licensed attorney who could explain the proceedings against the child and address any deficiencies that the child has in his or her understanding, and do that over a graded amount of time, longer exposure than an evaluator could in just an hour or two session.
Counsel, can we tell from our record what standard the juvenile court applied in determining the question of competency?
Judge, I don't think the record is clear about what standard the juvenile court used.
What standard does the state suggest should be applied?
At this time, I think that at the very least, while I don't want to be imputing more of the criminal code onto the juvenile code, I think that the standard set forth in 29-1823 provides a decent framework for how to assess competence and whether competence can be restored within the foreseeable future.
Well, you're talking about the decision tree, if you will, or the procedure after competency is determined. I'm asking a different question. By what standard, against what standard, does the state suggest competency should be measured in juvenile court?
Are you asking in terms of whether it should be assessed?
Is it the Dewey-Guatney standard? Is it some softened version of that? What have other states done? What is the state recommending in this case?
I think that a softer approach to the a softer approach to competence as opposed to one you would find in adult court. These are minor children. That is specifically the reason that the juvenile code exists. They are not competent to stand trial in adult court. So a softer standard of competence to be required should be measured against their development. A 14-year-old, like in this case, would very likely have a lower threshold for competence than a 45-year-old.
So if a 14-year-old was charged with first-degree murder in criminal court, you don't take the position that there couldn't be a competency evaluation and that the standard Dewey-Guatney inquiry would govern whether that child was competent to stand trial?
I think that if we are approaching it as... I'm only speaking as to how we should address things in juvenile court, only rather than whether we're charging children as adults. I think that in juvenile court itself, there is a lower standard for, there should be a lower standard for competence because they are minor children. They do have lower abilities to understand.
What do you mean by a lower standard of competence?
In the sense that we are not holding them to the same, they are not developmentally the same as adults. They are younger. They have different levels of critical reasoning and thinking skills.
So it should be easier to find them incompetent?
No, in the sense that it should be, not that it should be easier to find them incompetent, but that they if there is a concern about competence for a child that they don't understand the proceedings against them, that there should be rehabilitative steps taken to help them understand. I mean, essentially in this case, this child hasn't gone to school for a number of months or at this point years. And one of the ways in which that competence could be addressed would be to encourage him to go to school. That would be one of the things to help develop those critical thinking skills. There's an irony here in that the very thing that the state is seeking to help the state is seeking to adjudicate is the very thing that might be causing his lack of understanding. In the evaluation itself that the evaluator did in this case, the minor child understood far more than he didn't understand. He understood the difference between guilty pleas, plea bargains. He understood the adversarial process, the adversarial role of the prosecutor. He understood how a prosecutor uses evidence to prove something against you. He understood the impartial role of the judge. He understood how a judge uses evidence to decide a case. There are only four areas in which he didn't quite have a firm grasp of what was going on. And the evaluator in this case specifically stated that the child could be restored to competence.
But the state's not challenging the competency determination in this appeal, are you? You've not assigned error to that?
No, Your Honor.
All right. So the assignments of error, as I understand them, are the state contends, regardless of the child's competency, it was error not to proceed to adjudication.
Yes.
And if that's not right, then the court, the juvenile court, should have taken some other steps short of dismissal.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
So where in the text of any statute or in our jurisprudence anywhere do you find support for those propositions?
Well, one need only look at the very nature of the juvenile code. It is rehabilitative in nature and it's civil in nature. The competence requirements of an adult criminal case do not necessarily apply to a juvenile case, and it's rehabilitative in nature. What the appellee in this case is asking is that this court affirm that dismissal and that no rehabilitative services are offered to this child.
Excuse me for interrupting. I'm trying to follow when you think steps should be taken. Would the court have authority to take steps prior to a ruling? on competency or prior to the prior to a ruling of adjudication, a ruling that there is an adjudication thereafter gives the court a menu of options. But prior to such a ruling, what can the court do?
Do you mean prior to a finding of a petition to be true?
Right.
And do you mean attempts to restore a child to competence?
Well, I think that's what you're saying. The steps that I think you're proposing happen, let me liken it a little bit to a criminal proceeding. You know, before you have a plea, what's the authority of the court? That kind of thing. What's the breadth of authority before we know with whom we are dealing?
The legislature does provide an avenue for the court to assess competence, even pre-adjudication. But the legislature itself does not, like the juvenile code does not itself detail any specific avenues for the court to take once a finding of incompetence is made by an evaluator. I think one needs to look at the nature of juvenile court, which is to rehabilitate. I don't believe that the Nebraska juvenile code requires that competence be established in order to adjudicate a status offender.
If it doesn't require competency, why would 43-258 authorize a juvenile court to order an evaluation for purposes of determining the juvenile's competence to participate in the proceedings, end quote?
I think that would be, it's more of a guidepost. I think if there's concerns about a child not understanding the proceedings against him, I think that the ability of the juvenile court to order an evaluation like that and I see I'm out of time. It's all right if I can continue. So the juvenile court, I think that specific statute that you referenced should be used as a guidepost to assess whether or not the child understands what's going on and if the court should take steps to possibly appoint a guardian ad litem to safeguard that child's interest, or to appoint a guardian ad litem for the sake of restoration of competence as a method of restoration of competence. Have that guardian ad litem explain the proceedings against that child to address any specific deficiencies that an evaluation has identified. In this case, there were just four areas where the minor child was deficient in his understanding. An evaluation could be a method or a tool that a guardian ad litem could use to say, well, these are the specific areas that we need to touch on. These are the specific areas that this child is lacking in his understanding. And so these are the ones that we will address. And then the court from that point then could have check hearings later on to see if there has been any measured progress in the child's understanding. Again, this is ultimately—
Does the juvenile code specifically provide for dismissal based upon competency?
It does not. Not per se dismissal, no. And the adult criminal code does not either.
Now, in a truancy of 3B matter situation we have here, how young a child can that apply to?
To be honest, I don't know if there is a specific age requirement for a 3B offender.
Can a kindergartner have a 3B brought against them?
I think that in that case, it would be up to the state's discretion to look into why a kindergartner is not going to school and assess the home in that situation and possibly consider filings under a educational neglect under the 43-247.
At some point where the child is making the decision not to go to school as opposed to the parent not getting them.
Right. And that would be the difference between an educational neglect filing and a status offense filing. An educational neglect filing would be one that would attempt to rehabilitate the parent and address the issues in the parent, whereas a status offense case or petition is to address any deficiencies in the child who is choosing not to go to school.
And here the state determined it was the child choosing not to go to school as opposed to the parent not
the state
providing a method for them to get there.
Correct. The state had no evidence that there was a deficiency in the parent, and the evidence presented to the state by the school suggested that a 3B filing was the most appropriate. And again, the state has prosecutorial discretion to choose which actions to bring forward. In this case, the evidence suggested that a 3B filing was the most appropriate.
I beg your pardon. Is there a constitutional dimension to this discussion? And does the juvenile have some constitutional rights before the case proceeds?
Yes, the juveniles do have constitutional rights. And I know that in her brief, Appalee mentioned U.S. v. Galt. I would argue that that applies to delinquency cases. Status offenses are civil in nature. And although the rights advisories for the two might seem, and I know in her brief she mentions this, the rights advisories are similar, the dispositions are not. And there is a fundamental difference between status offenses and delinquencies. This court has held that in Ray Interest Kevin K, that delinquencies are fundamentally different from status offenses. And so I would argue that while the Constitution can provide a framework for protections of a child who's charged with a status offense, those offenses are not criminal in nature, and the full due process rights that are afforded to criminal offenders should not apply to status offenders, again, primarily because of the rehabilitative efforts of the court. There's no moral condemnation upon the child for committing a status offense, especially in this case of truancy. There's no moral aspect to this, no condemnation of the child. And so the state would argue that when citing Galt in her brief, Appalee makes mention of how that applies to delinquency cases. But again, this case in interest here today is not a delinquency case. And I am very much over time, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Ellis, good morning to you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Lee Ellis, and I represent the youth in this case, Victor L. Before I dig into the details, which I hope to point out to this court, I would like to remind this court that Victor was 14 years old at the time that the truancy petition was filed, and there have been two competency evaluations done in this case by two different providers, both of whom have come to the same conclusion, that he is, in fact, incompetent.
Are both competency evaluations on our record, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. The first competency evaluation was attached to the motion to dismiss I filed, and the second competency—
Did that make it into our record on appeal?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Is it in a bill of exceptions?
I would have to double check that, Your Honor.
Assume it's not in the bill of exceptions. Are you arguing that just because something is attached to a motion, it somehow becomes evidence?
It was my understanding that it was part of the record. If I'm mistaken, I apologize. So there are a couple of points I would like to make regarding this case, the first of which is that due process applies. We know that juvenile court proceedings are not required to conform to the same standards as a criminal trial. That said, the Supreme Court has told us, and Nebraska statute advises, that juvenile court proceedings must measure up to the essentials of due process and fair treatment. What we know that to mean from case law and statute is that juveniles are entitled to certain rights. In particular, I'm referring to the Juvenile Code Sat 43-279, which is the rights advisement.
From a constitutional standpoint, do you take the position that there can be no difference between a delinquency offense and a status offense?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that our statute makes clear that these rights advisements apply to both delinquencies and status offenders alike.
I was asking about constitutional standpoint. Do you have any authority for the proposition that there cannot be a constitutional difference between status offense and delinquency offense?
So with regard to due process, we really need to look to Galt and Winship, the Supreme Court cases that outline those rights. And in those cases, especially Galt, what it makes clear is that these due process rights attach when the youth faces a restriction of liberty and specifically an out-of-home placement.
Weren't both of those cases delinquency?
They were, Your Honor, but I would suggest that status offenders, like delinquencies, face the same out-of-home placement possibilities. Thus, the distinction is simply semantics.
Thank you.
So we know due process applies. Our Nebraska statutory authority tells us so. And we know that juveniles have certain rights, such as the right to counsel, the right to notice. the right against self-incrimination, the right to confront and cross-examine. And again, that's all laid out in statute, which specifies it applies to both delinquents and status offenders. So number one, due process applies. Number two, we know competency matters. Raising the point that you mentioned earlier, Your Honor, we have two statutes in the juvenile code that explicitly mention competency. First, we have 43-258, and that's the statute that allows the juvenile court to have a youth evaluated to determine how that youth can participate in the proceeding.
Would it be fair to characterize, assume for a moment that we disagree with you, that the constitutional due process standards are identical in delinquency and status offenses? I know you're arguing to the contrary, but assume for the moment that we think you're wrong. You're also arguing that the statutory basis in our state statute would be the same for delinquency and status, right?
I am, Your Honor.
So that really is your strongest argument, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
If we were to adopt your position, would it be fair to say that incompetent children would be immune from juvenile adjudication under the truancy statutes?
Yes, but I do want to make clear that this does not leave those youth without access to services. This is a point that I make in my brief. The state has different avenues by which they could acquire jurisdiction over juveniles. And in this instance, the state had the option of pursuing a 43-247-3A, so an educational neglect.
They should pursue the parent.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So treat them as your opponent said, a younger child, how they would pursue a younger child who would be going through an adjudication of the parent.
Yes, that's correct. In this instance, it would not offend due process as there would it would not require a finding of fault on the part of the youth. However, the youth would still be subjected to services, rehabilitative services. And actually, the court has access to far more services through an educational neglect filing. So I would argue that that's the beneficial route to go in this instance.
You seem to be advocating, or I understood you to concede, that if the court were to adopt your position, that incompetent juveniles would be immune from a truancy adjudication. And I want to explore the edges of that with you a little bit. Are you suggesting that there's some provision in statute or in our case law that limits a juvenile court judge's discretion once he or she determines a child is incompetent to proceed to adjudication?
No, there's no statutory authority whatsoever or
then
case law.
Why is dismissal required?
I think dismissal was the only option in this case. Due process, we have such an importance attached to due process that it necessitates a consistent and specific framework, which is why in the criminal code, we have a whole statute dedicated to it. Juvenile court is a court of limited jurisdiction, meaning it is the responsibility of the legislature to adopt a statutory framework to be utilized by the juvenile court judge. I believe in this instance, juvenile court had no choice but to dismiss.
Aren't we required by statute to construe the juvenile code in a way that accomplishes the goals of the juvenile code, one of which is to intervene in these situations where a juvenile is not going to school and provide services and get that remedied?
You're correct, Your Honor.
How can we accomplish that goal if we construe the statute the way you're suggesting that we do?
I would like to make 2 points. So also in the same section you're citing in the statute, that's 43-246, it also mentions that the juvenile code must be construed in such a way that the parties are assured a fair hearing and that the constitutional and other legal rights are recognized and enforced. So we can't compromise the rehabilitative goals with the constitutional rights of the youth. And speaking to your second point, there are still ways that this youth can access services through an educational neglect proceeding. So this
how does all of this square with the presumption that the children are incompetent because of their age to begin with?
That's a great question, Your Honor. So to that, I would say that, yes, arguably all children are incompetent. However, this is an instance where we have a 14-year-old, someone who the law recognizes is of age to have a petition filed against them. And then we have two licensed psychologists saying that while this youth ought to be able to understand this situation, the fact of the matter is that this youth does not. Thus, that's the distinction. This is not an issue of immaturity. This is an instance where
there's more than one kind of incompetency that we have to deal with.
Yes, Judge. I think it's important to distinguish between immaturity and incompetency. The state makes the argument that the appointment of a guardian ad litem would resolve any incompetency issues that we may have. I think that's wrong for three reasons. Number one, the Nebraska Juvenile Code specifically outlines the instances in which the juvenile court can appoint a guardian ad litem for a youth. That specific statutory citation is 43-272. The particular reasons mentioned in the statute are when the juvenile does not have a parent, when the parent cannot be located, when the parent is excused from the proceeding, when the parent is themselves a juvenile, or if the parent is incompetent. If the parent is indifferent to the interests, and if this is in fact an abuse and neglect proceeding. Accordingly, the plain meaning of the statute does not allow for the appointment of a guardian ad litem for an incompetent youth. The second reason why I believe that the appointment of a guardian ad litem does not remedy the issue is because it doesn't attend to the underlying due process concerns, meaning a guardian ad litem cannot restore competency, nor can the guardian ad litem assure that this youth is able to understand the charges and engage with defense. And finally, the state relies on case law out of the Court of Appeals of Missouri, that's NRE-AGR, and that case law is so distinguishable from what we have here that it's not applicable. Specifically, that case law makes clear in the first few pages of the opinion that the due process rights do not apply to juveniles. It also references its own case law that cites the appropriateness of a guardian ad litem to resolve concerns of incompetency. This is in direct conflict with the statutory authority that we have in the juvenile code.
You've already said this, I apologize, but what options does the juvenile code provide for dealing with incompetent youth?
The juvenile code provides us with no statutory framework, nor is there any guidance to show the court how to respond, which again is why I believe the court did what it, the only option it had available to dismiss. This really is an issue for the legislature because due process is so important. We do need a thought out and consistently applied framework.
Thank you. I beg your pardon, if I may. I know this is not a criminal proceeding, but we sometimes encounter where somebody's been overcharged. Is that helpful? This is wrongly charged. This could be brought back in another manner. And would we have any better tools to address the juvenile's competency under 3A?
There's no indication that this has been overcharged. Again, the allegations are such that Victor did not attend school. However, there are other avenues by which we could provide services, and that's through the 3A educational neglect docket.
Was there anything in our record that suggested that this mother was neglecting to get her child to school? Or doesn't our record suggest that the mother was active and engaged in doing everything she possibly could, and the child was of an age where he was beginning to resist her parenting and she had no options?
What we have in the record pertaining to the involvement of the mother is in the competency evaluation completed by Dr. Perez. So that is the only mention of the mother's ability to parent that's made available to us in the record.
It's at least possible that you could have a case with an involved parent who's doing everything they can, but the child is of such an age that they're existing. And if that child's incompetent and educational neglect filing is not available, options.
There is still another option under 43-247C. There is an option to bring about a case when the youth is deemed to be mentally ill or unruly. I believe that's the specific terminology that's used.
Is it mentally ill and dangerous?
That sounds more correct, Your Honor.
So in this case, is there any evidence of dangerousness by this individual?
There is some indication of that in the first psychological or competency evaluation. However, I'm not sure, again, that you had access to that. May I be excused?
You may be excused. Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
Yeah.
There is no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments in re interest of Victor L. Counsel, as you leave the chamber this morning, please use the side door to my left, and please continue to appropriately social distance and use those masks. Thank you very much.